Radio Borders Youth Association. Good day, everybody. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today is 16th of November. We will continue listening to Master Tenjin Chosen's program with the book Mind Trainings Like the Rays of Sun by Lam Kapel. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146 Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome to the program once more. In another program some time ago, I quoted a song by the 1970s-80s band The Boomtown Rats. You know, the band fronted by one Bob Geldof. The song was their first hit, and the lyrics went like this. The world owes me a living. I've waited on this dull queue too long. I've been standing in the rain for 15 minutes. That's a quarter of an hour too long. I'll take all they can give me, and then I'm going to ask for more, because the money's buried deep in the Bank of England, and I want the key to the vault. And the chorus goes, I'm going to take your money, count your loss when I'm gone. I'm all right, Jack, I'm looking after number one. If I want something, I get it, don't matter what I have to do. I'll step on your face, on your mother's grave. Never underestimate me, I'm nobody's fool. I'm going to take your money, count your loss when I'm gone. I'm all right, Jack, I'm looking after number one. Don't want to be like you, don't want to live like you, don't want to talk like you at all. Don't give me love thy neighbor, don't give me charity, don't give me peace and love or the good Lord above. You only get in my way with your stupid ideas. I'm an island entirely of myself, and when I get old, older than today, I'll never need anybody's help in any way. I'm going to take your money, count your loss when I'm gone. I'm all right, Jack, I'm looking after number one. Don't want to be like you, don't want to live like you, don't want to talk like you at all. I'm going to be like, I'm going to be like, I'm going to be like me. Now, if you're as old as I am, you may remember Bob Geldof's famous line at the time about what he wanted out of life. Get rich, get famous, and get laid, he said. But achieving those three self-focused aims wasn't what made Geldof a household name. He will forever be associated with mammoth fundraising events for the world's poor, like Band-Aid. In other words, from a youthful ambition that was primarily self-focused, Geldof developed into one of the most well-known of the world's philanthropists. Now you may ask what this has got to do with a mind training like the rays of the sun, the text that we've gone back to after my journey to India. Well, if you were with us last week, you may remember that I briefly revisited the material we'd already gone through in the months before I left New Zealand. Mind Training Like the Sun is a commentary on another text called The 7 Points of Mind Training. And last week, we came to the point where the original text advises banish the one to blame for everything. Before my pilgrimage, we spent a number of programs exploring what this meant. And if you remember, the one to blame for everything is our misconception of how we exist. We have this idea that there is an essential me or self that is inherent and independent and quite different from all others. In reality, we do not exist in that way. But as Nam Kar Pal explains in his commentary, we sentient beings run after misery that we do not desire and never achieve what we wish. At the root of it all is we seek to lay the blame elsewhere, which is a mistake. This is because all the various lengthy and violent sufferings that come from being born among the 5 or 6 kinds of existence, from the hell without respite to the peak of existence, are not without causes, nor do they arise from unrelated causes. These come about in dependence upon the actions and disturbing emotions that give rise to everything. Since actions are caused by disturbing emotions are the primary factor. Moreover, amongst the disturbing emotions, it is the ignorance that clutches onto a misconception of self that is the primary source of all misery. So, basically, from a Buddhist perspective, we can trace all our miseries back to this misconception of the self, which grossly manifests itself in such outpourings of self-centeredness as the Boomtown Rat song, Looking After Number One. I'm going to take your money, count your loss when I'm gone. I'm all right, Jack. I'm looking after number one. If I want something, I get it. Don't matter what I have to do. I'll step on your face and your mother's grave. Never underestimate me. I'm nobody's fool. And this kind of attitude is based on the misconception of the self that Namkha Pal says is the source of all our unhappiness. Maybe in some dark recess of his mind, Bob Geldof came to recognize, if not the eye grasping itself, then at least its unfortunate and unhappy effects. When one night he heard a news report about the famine in Ethiopia, I felt disgusted and ashamed by what was going on in Africa, and I felt that if I didn't do something, I was taking part in some crime. It wasn't enough to put my hand in my pocket and give money, he told a reporter. And so was born Band Aid, Live Aid, and some of the most significant charity of the 20th century. But now, we've gone on long enough without thinking about our motivation for today. So before we continue, let's think about our intentions for participating in the program. Why are you listening in today? Is it for some fairly limited aim based on the misconception of the self that is always on the lookout for some advantage? I'm listening to this program so my friends will admire me as a good religious person. Isn't this just the same concern, if less confrontational, as the Boomtown Rats looking after number one? In fact, any motivation that promotes the agenda of the misconceived self will lead to the same unhappy results. So if we find there is even a hint of this kind of motivation, let's change it for an intention to attain enlightenment, at least for ourselves, but more importantly, for the contentment and well-being of all beings. Now let's take a brief moment to set our motivation. In the last how many programs, we have explored the instruction in the 7 verses of mind training that reads, banish the one to blame for everything. That one, whose sole purpose is to bring unhappiness and grief into our lives, is the misconception that we have an independent and inherently existing I that must, under all circumstances, be protected. That is our misconception, for nothing exists in such an independent way, especially not the I or self. However, it is easy, not knowing the mistake we make, or even knowing it, to fall under the alluring spell of this illusory self and go on to act in ways that will result only in suffering. By taking the focus away from this misconceived but oh-so-real appearing I, the next instruction in the text helps us to connect to others and our kinship with them. It urges, meditate on the great kindness of all beings. And Namkha Pal writes, Chandrakirti states in his supplement to Nagarjuna's treatise on the Middle Way that in general, for a person to belong to the lineage of the great vehicle, that's a Mahayana, love and compassion are vitally important at the beginning, middle, and end of his or her practice. Both are developed in dependence on sentient beings. Love, by focusing on the fact that sentient beings are bereft of happiness, and sympathetic great compassion, by focusing on the fact that sentient beings are afflicted by suffering like a raging bonfire. The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life says that we make offerings to whoever has a mind of love also reflects the value of sentient beings. In addition, the awakening mind that seeks to gain unsurpassable enlightenment must be preceded by love and compassion, which in turn are developed in dependence on sentient beings. Seeing that only a fully awakened being has the ability to eliminate every last hindrance and misery and establish every single sentient being without exception in a state of happiness and well-being, stirred by love and compassion, we should activate the awakening mind that wishes to attain the complete awakened state of being. Maitreya Asanga's Ornament of Clear Realization says, generating the awakening mind is the desire for completely perfected full awakening for the sake of others. Namkalpal goes on, the four ways of amassing disciples, that's giving, speaking pleasantly, teaching, and acting in accordance with the teachings, and the six transcending perfections, that's generosity, ethics, patience, enthusiasm, meditative stability, and discriminating intelligence, are also developed in dependence on sentient beings, as is abiding in and repeatedly enhancing the awakening mind. Therefore, we can see that the basis of our conduct, the source of the awakening mind, love and compassion, the basis of the practice, the generation of the altruistic mind, and the essence of our own training arise in dependence on sentient beings. The accumulation of all manner of causes for accomplishing the fruit of Buddhahood depends on sentient beings. Even after the highest attainment of complete awakening, the practice of enlightened activity, which comes about in an unbroken stream, arises in dependence on sentient beings for whom it's done. Essentially, at the root of everything in the great vehicle, the causes and the result, is the concern for sentient beings. As the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life says, whenever I turn my gaze upon a sentient being, thinking I shall fully awaken through depending upon this being, I should look at her with open-hearted love. In his commentary, His Holiness the Dalai Lama echoes Namkalpal's lines when he refers to the practice manual of the Guru Puja, or offering to the spiritual masters, which states that cherishing others is the gateway to all good qualities. He also refers to Namkalpal's quote from Chandrakirti, which indicates that the source of all the Buddha's qualities is their great compassion. Where does this compassion come from? He asks, and replies, it comes from cherishing and having intense concern for others. So the root of all happiness and qualities comes from cherishing others. Cherishing others brings us to develop love and compassion, which brings us to develop a bodhicitta aim, and bodhicitta aim brings us to enlightenment. All these vast-minded Mahayana states of mind, love, compassion, exceptional resolve, and bodhicitta, are aimed at other beings. So the root of all good qualities that come from all these states of mind is cherishing others. As for how these qualities continuously improve and don't degenerate, this is also due to being focused on others and cherishing them. Likewise, the attainment of the result, namely Buddhahood, comes from this sustained concern for others. Thus, the generation, continuation, and attainment of the result of these positive states of mind all come from cherishing others. Even the strength of the enlightening influence of the Buddhas, that too comes about because of others, out of concern for and cherishing them. In the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Shantideva says, therefore the Mighty One has stated that there are the field of sentient beings and the field of Buddhas, for many who have pleased them have thereby reached perfection. And also, even if, in order to pay respect to someone in whom a mere portion of good qualities of the unique collection of excellence exists, we were to present the three realms, it would be insufficient. Since the qualities of full awakening are derived from sentient beings and conquerors alike, how can we act respectfully towards conquerors and not towards sentient beings? We should foster such an attitude. Since all sentient beings have a portion of the Buddha's supreme qualities, for this reason alone, sentient beings are worthy of respect. Namkalpal places these quotes in his text, so let's have a look at what is being said here. Basically, if we ask what do we have to depend on to attain enlightenment, it comes down to two main objects, or as the text calls them, fields. That is, the enlightened beings and the sentient beings. Of course, no matter how highly the Tibetans extol the guru, placing him or her on a pedestal even higher than that of the Buddha, if we didn't have Buddhas to bring the enlightened experience to us, we would be lost. We would not be able to attain enlightenment without an immense amount of prior work and difficulty. Think of those before the Buddha's time. How many became fully enlightened? From the viewpoint of the early Buddhists, none. It was only when the Buddha came and taught that his followers could even become arhats. So, for the attainment of enlightenment, we need the Buddhas to teach and guide us. But as much as we need the Buddhas and great highly realized teachers, we need other beings. The Buddha might tell us to practice loving kindness and compassion, but how can we do that without others as objects of our practice? There's that story of the old man walking along the road when a rider comes hurtling along on his horse. To save himself from being hit and run over, the old man has to dive into a ditch. Once the rider has galloped past, the old man clambers out of the ditch and shouts at him, "May you be blessed. May your deepest desires be fulfilled." The passerby, who sees the whole episode, is amazed and asked, "Why would you wish such a good thing for someone who nearly killed you?" The old man looks at him and replies, "If his deepest desires were fulfilled, he would have no need to run an old man off the road." Now, I don't know if the old man was a Buddhist, but he certainly had a Buddhist attitude. All things being usual, wouldn't we expect the old man to haul himself out of the ditch, cursing and swearing at the horseman? But what would that have achieved? The horseman would still have ridden away with a mind of arrogance, and the old man would have yielded to a mind of anger. In both cases, we can see negative mind at work. By wishing the greatest good for the horseman, the old man was not only replacing any hatred of the horseman with goodwill, but he was protecting his own mind from anger and negativity. Would he have been able to learn to so protect his mind if there had been no arrogant horsemen and their like in the world? No, because he would only have come across friendly, well-meaning people. So in this sense, the arrogant riders of the world can be most beneficial for us if we are able to use them to change our habitual conditioned negative responses. The attainment of Buddhahood depends on developing the bodhicitta attitude and developing the six perfections. But we can accomplish neither of those without depending on other beings. How can we practice generosity if we've got no one to give to? Ethics, if there's no one to benefit or harm? Patience, if no one is ever angry or irritating to us? Enthusiasm, if there are no beings to work for? Concentration, if nothing exists to disturb us? And wisdom, without others to discriminate between? And it would be nonsense to say I want to attain full enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings if no other sentient beings exist. As a funny little example, here's a story I found on the internet that demonstrates how we need others to practice patience. It also shows how we might actually do the practice. It goes like this. A man observed a woman in a grocery store with a 3-year-old girl in her basket. As they passed the cookie section, the little girl asked for cookies, and her mother told her no. The little girl immediately began to whine and fuss. The mother said quietly, "Now, Monica, we just have half of the aisles left to go through. Don't be upset, it won't be long." Soon they came to the candy aisle, and the little girl began to shout for candy. And when told that she couldn't have any, began to cry. The mother said, "There, there, Monica. Only 2 more hours to go, and then we'll be checking out." When they got to the checkout stand, the little girl immediately began to clamor for gum and burst into a terrible tantrum upon discovering there would be no gum purchased. The mother patiently said, "Monica, we'll be through this checkout in 5 minutes, and then you can go home and have a nice nap." The man followed them out into the parking lot and stopped the woman to compliment her. "I couldn't help noticing how patient you were with little Monica," he said. Whereupon the mother said, "I'm Monica. My little girl's name is Tammy." Even in mundane situations, like going to the supermarket with the child, we can see that our spiritual journey is as dependent on the presence of other sentient beings as it is on the presence of the Buddhas. As His Holiness says in his commentary, in order to achieve enlightenment, as explained in these quotations, we need both the enlightened influence of the Buddhas as well as the bountiful field of all limited beings. It is on the basis of both of these that we actually achieve enlightenment. Its attainment cannot occur independently of others, but has to be based on our benefiting them as much as possible. So it's not just enough to have respect for the Buddhas. It is necessary to have respect for all limited beings as well, since our achievement of enlightenment comes equally on the side of the Buddhas and on the side of all limited beings. In that sense, the Buddhas and all limited beings are equal in kindness. So realizing this, don't you think that we should then value other sentient beings as much as we value the Buddhas? Namkhal Pal goes on to point out that valuing others brings many advantages, while not valuing them brings us much suffering. He writes, "It is said that accomplishing the welfare and happiness of sentient beings gives rise to higher status and definite goodness, whereas every kind of trouble arises from neglecting sentient beings." He then quotes a text by Nagarjuna that states, "In this world, pleasant and miserable existences are the desired and unwanted results that arise respectively from helping or harming sentient beings. Should you rely on sentient beings, you will regain the fully awakened state. There's not a single person in the three realms who has not taken birth as Brahma, Indra, or Vishnu, the protectors of the world, solely through helping sentient beings. What could be more marvelous than that? The many types of suffering experienced by sentient beings as hell denizens, animals, and hungry spirits arise from harming sentient beings. The miseries of hunger, thirst, eating one another, and being overwhelmed by pains that are unrelenting and difficult to avoid are the result of harming sentient beings. This means that not only gaining eventual enlightenment, but also experiencing both positive rebirths and good conditions in samsara are the result of caring for other beings. But also all our sufferings, from terrible rebirths to moments of hunger, come from caring for ourselves and neglecting others." He goes on to explain, "The harm sentient beings presently appear to be doing us is fundamentally caused by the disturbing emotions in our own mind streams over beginningless time. The auxiliary conditions are the tendencies remaining from actual harm we've done against sentient beings over beginningless time. Due to the activation of such causes and conditions, those who harm us are motivated by evil thoughts, for which reason they engage in numerous cruel and misguided acts against us. In general, throughout limitless cyclic existence, the blame for our experience of various miseries, such as those of the three bad rebirths in particular, rests with our self-centered attitude. I came across an article on the website Quora that goes a little way in shedding light on what Namkhal Pal is saying here. It is not all that comprehensive, but it gives some insight into how, by passing on our suffering, we create evil. The article starts with a subheading, Suffering In. It is by Diane Merriweather, who writes, "When I was two, my mother broke my arm because I couldn't stop crying. My mother had dreamed of having children, but she struggled with rage. Looking back now, I know she was horrified and ashamed by what she had done. To my mother, evil was something that made her feel bad. After my broken arm, that something was me. It eased her discomfort to believe that she was only responding to my true nature. She was a victim, if you will, of her child's darkness. She was able to convince each of her four children, including me, of this truth, and the disastrous consequences curse my family to this day. And yet, I'm quite lucky." The subheading of the next part of the article is Suffering Out. She continues, "When I was about four, my father found me in the backyard killing insects. He told me later that he saw some joy in my body language, some delight in my eyes that frightened him, and he tried to imagine what his father would have done. He sat down near me and, saying nothing, he started looking at one of the bugs I'd smashed. Soon, I came over to see what he was doing. 'Look,' he said, 'where do you think he was going?' I squatted beside him and looked. 'His mummy was very busy with other little bugs at home,' he said. He told me a story about a little bug who was always getting into trouble. But this morning, his mummy trusted him to go to the store for her. She gave him a quarter and told him to bring home a loaf of bread. 'Is she waiting for him?' I wanted to know. 'I imagine she is,' he said. I started to cry. I sat in his lap and sobbed and hiccuped and cried again. I covered his shirt in tears. He tells me he was sure he'd screwed everything up. Finally, I stopped crying I told him, "I know what we can do." We picked up the little bug very carefully in a leaf and carried him to where we decided his mother's house was. We set him gently in the dirt and went to have some ice cream. For much of that summer, I could be found squatting over anthills, following little beetles, watching, wondering. Now, part three of the article is headed "The Dynamics of Suffering and Compassion and Evil." It reads, "If you have ever had your heart broken or lost someone you love, you know the way emotional pain can move around inside you, shutting your throat, twisting in your stomach, pressing down on your heart. This traveling pain is my definition of suffering. Emotion comes from the Latin emovere, which literally means to move. When suffering is upon us, we have two options. We can process and digest it, or we can pass it on. Processing emotional pain can be as silent as pressing our hand to your chest and rocking back and forth, or it can be as loud as a scream that starts in your throat and tunnels down through your gut, through your knees, and tears a channel into the earth. Working through pain can happen in an instant when you finally stop running, drop your hands, and invite what's been chasing you to kill you if it must. Or the process can last years, playing hide and seek with the sweetness of a memory. In time, the processed suffering may transform into wisdom or compassion. My definition of evil is suffering passed along to someone else. In the process, whatever started the pain is lost, and the energy moves as revenge or cruelty until someone else can bring it to the ground. In July 1995, 8,000 men and boys were massacred in Srebrenica. Later, there was an interview where a man justified his part in the murder. He explained that his son had been killed by Bosnian Muslims. I remember being floored. How could it be that someone who had suffered the loss of a child could ever want anyone else to feel that way? But of course, what he was hoping to do was to not feel the loss, to turn it into heat and blast it onto someone else's heart. Tears are the original holy water. I learned how not to be evil on my father's lap. Now I leave you to meditate on that for the coming week. For now, our time is up. Thank you very much for joining us today, and I hope you will tune in again next week. Please dedicate any positive energy from the program to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.